So today I'll prove that if you take the Hecke algebra, which is T adjoining the Hecke operators, T1, which is Z adjoining the Hecke operators, T1, T2, T3, and so on, and you just tensor it up to C. So by this I mean C adjoining the Hecke operators, T1, T2, and so on, which we're going to view as a, for today, as a subring of the endomorphism ring of S2, gamma 0 of n. So you can think of this, after choosing a basis, as a ring of n by m matrices, and this is just the subring generated by these specific elements of that ring. Well, there's a natural pairing between T and S2 gamma 0 of n. So here are T sub C and S2 gamma 0 of n to the complex numbers. And this is a perfect pairing. And I'll prove that in complete detail to you. The proof is interesting. And once we have that, you get as immediate consequence that S2 gamma 0 of n is exactly the same thing as the homomorphisms from T to C. So if you can compute the abstract ring T in any way at all, for example, by considering its action on modular symbols, where you get a completely isomorphic ring, then you can recover S2 gamma 0 of n in a completely straightforward manner. I'll show you every detail of that today. And when you understand that, then you see that really the game is to compute T. So that's what today will be about. And the plan is that I will clearly and carefully prove this statement, that this is a perfect pairing, and what the, well, I can tell you what the pairing is, and so on. And then if I have time when I'm done doing that, and the proof, by the way, is simply, it's really just the first page and a half of the notes. If I'm done and I have time, then I'll show you a number of examples that illustrate how to use this in practice to very quickly get a basis for modular or cuspidal modular forms from writing down a couple of matrices of Hecke operators. Yes? Yes, it's not a term in common usage apparently, but a perfect pairing is a bilinear pairing on two vector spaces. These are both complex vector spaces. It's a bilinear pairing on the vector spaces that is non-degenerate. That's all it means here, because this is over the complex numbers. Perfect has a little bit deeper meaning if you work over, say, Z or something, where non-degenerate isn't the same thing as setting up an isomorphism of one to the dual of the other. But all it means is non-degenerate for us, because we're working over Z. So I can simply delete the word perfect and write non-degenerate. It's a sort of... So that's it, I'll just say. So there's a pairing, and it's non-degenerate. What I'm going to do on Wednesday is introduce Dirichlet characters, which will play a big role in the course. I'm just going to give you a kind of brief overview of Dirichlet characters. I could talk for 2 weeks about them, but I don't think it's really necessary. So I'll just give you a kind of a brief overview of how they work and then get on to other things. And on Friday, Chuck Duran is going to give a guest lecture, since I'll be in Berkeley, and I think he's going to talk about something related. He's not going to talk about topological modular forms. He's going to talk about something else that's related to his research and closely related to modular forms. Okay, so that's the schedule, the upcoming schedule. And this talk today is a series number theory talk on root numbers of abelian varieties. Abelian varieties are just generalizations of elliptic curves to higher dimension. The definition of an abelian variety is just a projective group variety. Any projective group variety, it's a theorem that the group structure has to be abelian, so you call them abelian varieties. And the case of projective group variety dimension 1, you have a one-dimensional commutative compact algebraic group, so it has to be an elliptic curve. And so the elliptic curves are exactly the abelian varieties of dimension 1. In fact, people used to call elliptic curves abelian varieties of dimension 1, and now they're just called elliptic curves. And we'll talk about these in more generality. And the root number, well, in the Bertrand-Sorensen-Dyer conjecture, you have this thing associated to an elliptic curve named as L function, and it's a theorem of Hecke that the L function, well, given that the elliptic curve is modular, it's than a consequence of Hecke, that the L function satisfies a functional equation, which looks like the following. If you define lambda thus to be some extra functions that you put out here called gamma factors, then lambda of s is equal to some number epsilon times lambda of 2 minus s. You have a symmetry like that. This epsilon is either plus 1 or minus 1. And it's called the root number of the elliptic curve. And an interesting reason that you might consider epsilon is that if epsilon is minus 1, then the function lambda has to vanish at 1, because lambda of 1 is equal to minus lambda of 1. And if lambda vanishes at 1, that forces L to vanish at 1. And then the Bertrand-Sorensen-Dyer conjecture tells you that if L vanishes at 1, if BSC were true, then you would know that the elliptic curve has infinitely many rational points. So that's why the root number is interesting. And for basic probabilistic reasons, one believes the root number for an elliptic curve is minus 1 exactly half the time, and plus 1 exactly half the time, in almost any reasonable family of elliptic curves. But she's going to say something, I don't know what, about root numbers in a more general context, about these numbers which are plus 1 or minus 1 for elliptic curves and somehow control whether or not the group of rational points is infinite. That's just a little reason that if you're interested in this sort of thing, then you might be interested in Maria's talk. Okay, so now I'm going to prove this, unless there are any questions. By the way, one quick comment. I noticed while looking at your homework that some people were confused by the fact that if you consider M2 gamma 0 of n, or more generally Mk gamma 0 of n, it doesn't have the same dimension as the space of modular forms, Mk gamma 0 of n. So since I haven't defined this, I'll just put a 2. But that might deeply disturb you, the fact that these two don't have the same dimension. But in fact, they don't. The reason, well, what's true is that the dimension of this space is the dimension of the Eisenstein subspace of M2 gamma 0 of n plus twice the dimension of the cuspidal subspace of gamma 0 of n. So the dimension of M2, this M2, is equal to that sum of two things. And the reason that you have the, remember this is a Z module, so when I write the dimension here, I really mean rank as a Z module. And the reason you have the 2 here is because over here these are dimensions of complex vector spaces. And also, really the reason for the 2, if you like, is that the cuspidal modular symbols, that's isomorphic to the homology h lower 1 of x 0 of n. And this homology is free of rank 2g, where g is the dimension of s2 gamma 0 of n. So just the fact that homology is free of rank twice the genus that gives you this extra factor of 2 in the dimension. Okay, so hopefully this will be clarifying for anyone who tried computing modular symbols in SAGE and found that the dimension was too big compared to the dimension of the corresponding space of modular forms. Okay, so just a quick aside. Okay, any questions?
This is for the upcoming one, right? Like, as in the one that we're supposed to have in.
Yes. I saw some comment about this on the homework that was already handed in. Somebody was working with the tutorial and used modular symbols instead of modular forms and was surprised by the dimensions that came out, which are different than the dimensions for modular forms. Okay, so on to this. So how on earth are we going to establish any relationship between the Hecke algebra and this module over the Hecke algebra? To do this, here's what I'll do. So I'm going to define a pairing, and the first thing is, given an arbitrary Q expansion, sum bn q to the n, n equals 0 to infinity, let's let a sub m of f simply be the nth Fourier coefficient. Okay? So a sub m is a map from functions on the upper half plane that have a Q expansion to the complex numbers that sends something to its nth Fourier coefficient. That is the coefficient of q to the m. And now here's what the pairing is. So given a Hecke operator T and a modular form F, you pair the two as follows. It's A1 of T applied to F.
I hope. So that is a pairing between the Hecke algebra and cuss forms. And to check that it's a pairing at all, we just need to check that it's linear on each side. And that's pretty easy. These A sub n, these things that give the Fourier coefficient, they're linear maps, because if you take two functions and add them together, the Fourier expansion of the sum is the sum of the Fourier expansions. So T comma F plus G is T comma F plus T comma G, because I'm also using that T is linear. The Hecke operators act via linear transformations. So if you combine those two things, you get that. This is a bilinear pairing. And if you say multiply F by a scalar, that just factors out because T is linear, and then A1 is linear. If you multiply T by a scalar, same thing. So this is a bilinear pairing. Now the question is, why is it non-degenerate? So, in order to explain why this pairing is non-degenerate, I'm going to tell you how the Hecke operators act on Q expansions. So that's something I told you only so far in the case of level one. So here's how they act in general. I think I only need it for, oh no, I write it down in complete generality here. So this is how the Hecke operators act on elements of M2 gamma 0 of capital N. And this description of the action would be a perfect thing to give in a first course on modular forms, but unfortunately I'm sort of, in a sense, teaching you a second course on modular forms, even though you haven't had none of you have had a first one. So instead I'll give a reference to Deep Within Ling's book, Introduction to Modular Forms, which is one of Ling's best books, in my opinion. So Ling, Intro to Modular Forms, section 7.3. So there he gives a formula for the action of the Hecke operators on M2 gamma 0. There are a number of places where this is in the literature. Here's what it is. That was really fun in the notes because I completely neglect to take, there's a summation sign that's completely missing. It's sum n equals 0 to infinity, and then it's exactly what I wrote in the notes. Sum over 1 less than or equal to d, dividing GCD of n and m, that is the sum of the positive divisors of the GCD, of epsilon of d, I'll explain what epsilon of d is in a second, times d times times a sub m n over d squared q to the m. Okay, so this gives the nth coefficient of the q expansion of t n acting on this. And the only thing I haven't explained is what epsilon is. Epsilon of d is either 0 or 1. It's 0 if the GCD of d and capital N is not equal to 1. Otherwise, it's 1. It's actually an example of a Dirichlet character modulo N, by the way, which is what I'll talk about next time. Yes, you have a question.
Yeah. What is S2? Is this the thing that corresponds to the first?
Oh, I should have reminded you. So, yes. This is the thing that's dual to the first homology. Okay. S2 gamma 0 of n is the space of holomorphic functions on the upper half plane that's invariant under the action of gamma 0 of n. It says that f of z dz is invariant under gamma 0 of n.
There's also an S2 in bold, which is cuspidal modular symbols, and that's canonically isomorphic to integral homology. So this is cusp forms. These are, if you're comfortable with geometry, this is isomorphic to the space of differentials on the curve x0 to n.
Okay, and so is that a weight, the two?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. This is weight 2 cusp forms.
Okay.
Thank you for asking.
So it's just non-zero because we're over level n.
Yes, exactly. Level 1, this is a zero-dimensional space. If you go up for every single level up to 10, it actually has dimension 0. But then for 11, it has dimension 1. And then 12, I don't remember, 13 is dimension 0, 14 it has dimension 1, 15 it has dimension 1, 16 I think it has, I don't remember. But the dimensions is roughly n over 12. When n is 3 to 9, it has dimension 32, etc. Thank you for asking. So this is an example of a map from the integers to some subset of the complex numbers, and it's an example of it's actually the trivial Dirichlet character modulo n. When we talk about modular forms for gamma 1 of n, then the Heck operators will act with the same formula, except epsilon can be more complicated than it is here. Okay, so it's just a formula, but you can sort of see what it says. Hopefully you won't be thrown off by the missing sum sign here. Okay, so that's the action of Tn, and now I can explain to you why this is non-degenerate. But there's one important, I guess, lemma that we use, that will prove, that will just make everything else fall out easily. And the lemma is also good practice with the definition, and that's the following. Tn, if you apply Tn to a modular form f, and then take apply this A1 to it. So what am I doing? I'm really just computing the pairing of Tn and f. But what is it equal? Well, dang it, I feel like that Japanese guy. But what is it equal to? I went to this talk with this guy. Every sentence he said, but what? Which none of you want to, so you don't know what I'm talking about. But anyways. It's equal to something very simple. You can just read it off. So I don't even have to write down. Let's just read it off. So let's figure out what the coefficient is when m equals 1. Okay, it's just an application of the formula that's on the board. In an easy case, when m equals 1. So first, here n is an integer greater than or equal to 1. So it's the GCD of an integer greater than or equal to 1 with 1. 1, okay, good, on the same footing. So the only possibilities for D here are 1. So we have epsilon of 1 times 1 A sub n over 1. So this is A sub n of f. So the neat thing is if you pair Tn with f, you pick off the nth Fourier coefficient of f. That's what this formula says. And I can already see why this sort of thing might be true. If you had a modular form and it paired to 0 with every Heck operator, it would pair to 0 with all the t sub n, so all of its Fourier coefficients would be 0. So I just proved to you that that you can't have a modular form in here that pairs to 0 with everything else. So I just quickly told you why it's degenerate on one side. I mean, why it's non-degenerate on one side. But let me write down a little bit. So this is just by the formula. That's the proof of this. By the formula for Tn. And the real depth here is in proving that this is the correct description of the Heck operators on Q expansions. I didn't define it that way, so it really, and it's really tedious to check this. Okay, so that's this lemma. And now, I'm going to say more as I did in words, but I'm going to write down a little more about why this is perfect. Okay, so there are two steps. Perfect. I need to show, in order to show it's perfect, I have to suppose there's something in here that pairs to 0 with everything in there and prove that that thing is 0. The thing in here is 0. And then I have to take something in here that pairs to 0 with everything in there and then show that the Heck operator is 0. Okay, two steps. So one, suppose And I did this actually in words a minute ago. Suppose F in S2 gamma 0 then pairs to 0 with all of T. Okay? So then, what does that mean? Well, in particular, Tn f is equal to 0 for all n. But Tn f is equal to a sub n of f. And because f is a cusp form, this wouldn't work if f were a modular form and had possibly a non-zero constant term. We can't get any information about the constant term from this pairing, but f has zero constant term because it's a cusp form. So, what you have is that f is equal to sum a n of f q to the n for n greater than or equal to 1, and this is just a sum of zeros, so f is 0, and that proves the first part. Now the other direction. Suppose we have a Heck operator. Wait, any questions about this? Where are we going? Okay. So now suppose we have a Heck operator and it pairs to zero with everything. So two, suppose T is a Heck operator and T of is zero for all f in S2 gamma 0 of f. Okay, then that means that this is by definition A1 of Tf. That means that this is 0. So now what are we going to do? Any ideas? So, for every possible f, you have this condition. Can anybody think of something to do? To try, remember, what our goal is to show is that t is 0. Okay? Okay, we have an f, now what?
0.
True. Now what? Yep. Yes. That's a good observation. Heck operators leave cusp forms invariant. So how do you want to use that? Okay. So f with Tn's. So you have this for any possible f at all. So we fixed one. And now we're going to hit it by the T sub n's. Just get something about more than we already have. So you also know that because of this closure that I just pointed out, that all of these pairings, or all these numbers, are also 0. Okay, now what?
That operator is commutative.
Indeed. So write A1 TNT. That's also 0. But now look, this is just what I wrote down over here. So, in fact, this is equal to an of tf. That's 0. And this is true for any n. So we know that t of f is equal to 0. And that tells us that t, this element of the Heck algebra, acts as the 0 operator on cuspidal modular forms, which means it's 0, which is what we wanted to prove. Because we did this for every single f. This is true for any f. For all n and for all f, you have this. So that implies t is identically 0. It's the 0 operator. We've now proved non-degeneracy of the pairing. And you could almost, if you didn't know anything else from this course, just take this axiomatically and define a way for operators to act on power series. It's a fact that the operators commute as they act on power series. Just using that, really, and then we're considering power series that don't have a constant term, you get you get this non-degeneracy out. And we're just using just some properties of this formula. But the neat thing now is, now that we have this theorem that Hecke algebra and test forms are in perfect duality with one another. So what we just proved was that TC cross S2 gamma 0 n, that this is a non-degenerate pairing of complex vector spaces. That means that S2 gamma 0 of n is isomorphic, canonically actually, to the group of all homomorphisms, or the complex vector space of all homomorphisms from T to C. That's just another way of putting it. So let's call this canonical isomorphism psi. By the way, quick aside, which I won't use at all right now, what about all, you know, the C here, the fact this is a complex vector space, is there some integral version of this? And in fact, there is. If you get rid of the C's here and say Hong T to Z, then you get a lattice inside of here, and there's a corresponding Z module inside of S2 gamma 0 of N under this isomorphism. And it spans S2 gamma 0 of N. So there really is inside of, again, this is inside of, which I won't use right now, there's an S2 gamma 0 of N Z. There's a basis over Z for cusp forms of weight 2. By that I mean.
But that's complex span. So put the bottom span.
So here, what I mean by this is, let me define it. So S2 gamma 0 then embeds inside of C double brackets Q, power series, formal power series, and some indeterminate Q, if you like. Inside of C double brackets Q, there's a subring, which is Z double brackets Q. And S2 gamma 0 of NZ is by definition the intersection of the, well, it's the stuff in here that maps to Z double brackets Q. All modular forms, or all cuspidal modular forms that have integral Q expansion at infinity. So that's what this is. And in fact, these are in perfect duality. Or there's an isomorphism, as I've indicated. Again, that's an aside. I won't need that for what I'm doing, but I just wanted to point it out. Okay. And you can, in fact, do this. Once you have it over Z, then you get it over any ring. And it's an incredibly useful fact in practice. For example, a few days ago, I was looking at a referee report of the paper I wrote, and the referee said nowhere in the literature was it clearly stated that this had finite rank over Z and had this like two-page proof, complicated proof he wanted me to put in the paper. And you don't really immediately get that from this, but I guess you do, because, you know, there are nice ways to prove that, but just knowing this makes me immediately know sort of why T does have finite rank, because it's isomorphic to this S2 gamma 0 of N, and we know the dimension of this. So. The best way to prove that T has finite rank, though, at least in the weight 2 case, is T also acts as a ring of endomorphisms on the Jacobian of X0 of N. And that ring of endomorphisms embeds in a matrix ring over the integers, just by looking at the action on homology. And a subgroup of a ring of matrices is finite as a module over Z. In any case, I'm overloading you with the sides, and I will stop. We'll get back to the point. So we have an isomorphism like this. It would be nice to make it completely explicit. Given a homomorphism, how do you write down a Q expansion of a modular form? So I'll tell you how you do that. Back on track, no more sides. Make psi explicit. And here it is. So this is on the second page. And it's the following. If you have an element phi in Hong TC to C, so a homomorphism from TC to C, it's just a C module homomorphism, so a complex vector space homomorphism.
should be a homomorphism. Well, let's emphasize this. These are of C vector spaces. I mean, you can certainly also consider a Hom T C to C. You could consider the ring homomorphisms. And instead of getting a complex vector space, you get a finite set. And that's not what I'm considering here. If you consider those, though, you end up getting a finite set. It's actually the complex valued points of the spectrum of T, if you like. But you end up with a finite set. And that set corresponds exactly, corresponds exactly to the eigenforms for the Heck operators over here that are normalized so that the coefficient of Q is equal to 1. But again, I am failing to not do another one. So just so suppose you have a C vector space homomorphism. C vector spaces. Then here's how you explicitly write down a modular form. So really, I'm describing the inverse of psi. So here's a Q expansion, F phi equals sum, n equals 1 to infinity, phi of Tn, Q to the n. Okay? So this is an explicit Q expansion. It's the natural way to write down a Q expansion given such a homomorphism. I mean, how else would you assign a complex number to each integer n? Take the n-pack operator and take its image. So it's a natural thing to write down, and the fact of the matter is, it's an element of S2 gamma 0 of n. And the reason that it's in here is the following. Well, certainly F is a holomorphic function on the upper half plane, and it pairs in the right way with all of the Heck operators. It pairs in the same way as whatever the modular form is that corresponds to phi under this map. So let me verify that. So right now I'm going to explain why this is an element of that. Why? I mean, it's really pretty miraculous if you think about it. I took a homomorphism, I just formally wrote down a Q expansion. Why should this transform in the right way under gamma 0 of n to be a modular form? It's pretty amazing you actually get a modular form out of it. But here's why. Why are we making a modular form? How can we possibly really be getting a modular form in such an easy way? It's so amazing that I probably won't be able to convince myself that it's true. I'll try. So just notice that A1 Tn of F phi, this is equal to An F phi, is equal to phi of Tn, just by, so this equality is just by definition of F sub phi. The nth coefficient of S of phi is phi of Tn. And this is just, this part's just because of how the Heck operators act on Q expansions. And this is the pairing of F phi with Tn. So okay, so how can I convince you that this is correct, that that's really an S2 gamma 0 of n? There is some, because this is an isomorphism, there is some modular form, call it G. So there does exist a G. Since psi is an isomorphism, there exists a G in S2 gamma 0 of n, which we'll view as sitting inside C double brackets Q, such that G paired with Tn is equal to phi of Tn. Because that just characterizes how this homomorphism works. If you have a modular form
the homomorphism it goes to is pairing with that modular form. And I'm just using a size isomorphism, so there exists some G, so that pairing with it gives you the homomorphism phi. So I understand if you're getting confused because there's some duality going on here. That definitely confuses me when I listen to it. But I'm not confused right now, and there is such a G. And I wrote down explicitly a Q expansion with the property that it pairs to Tn, and you get the same thing. So the pairing of F phi with Tn is the same. So this F phi, though, is only in the space, I guess, of formal power series a priori. I don't know that it's a cusp form. It's just an element of the space of formal power series. But I can at least consider the difference of F phi and G in the space of formal power series in Q over the complex numbers. And I know that that pairs to zero with every element of Tn, just because they both pair to the same thing with Tn. So now I guess I have to prove, and I think that did come out of the proof, but I think I need to tell you something a little stronger than what I've told you so far, namely that if you look at the Hecke operators acting on formal power series, then if all the Hecke operators pair to zero with a formal power series, then the formal power series has to be zero. And that's just, I mean, the proof works exactly the same as before. Because if the Hecke operators pair to zero with the formal power series, then all the coefficients of the formal power series are zero. Therefore, the formal power series is zero. Zero in C double brackets Q. And here, by Tn acting on this, I don't mean, I just mean the linear map given by this formula. So there is a subtlety there, and I think that I've dealt with that successfully. Okay, any questions? Does it make sense? So the quick summary is this. There's a non-degenerate pairing between T and S2 gamma 0 of n that induces an isomorphism between cusp forms and the dual of the Hecke algebra. And explicitly, if you have an element of the dual of the Hecke algebra going in the other direction, the modular form that corresponds to it is given by this power series. Yes?
You somehow switch the order all the time. Like
yeah.
T and the S.
Yeah. So you use commutativity.
Okay. So you basically say that like the C double bracket Q cross TC to C is not degenerate on the left. You say exactly the same group.
Yeah.
And then
yes.
Tangent.
Yes. Yeah. It's not degenerate on one side if you replace this by C double brackets Q. And I'm not using commutativity of the Hecke operators in that case, which is good because I wouldn't want to verify that using that formula. I only use that in the other case. I mean, to get non-degeneracy of the pairing between T and C double brackets Q, all you need to use is Tn acting on this is the pairing of Tn acting on this one is just the nth coefficient. That just follows from the formula. So sorry that this isn't exactly in the notes, but I didn't really realize it was a subtle issue until right now. So that's why I haven't written in the notes. I just realized as I was explaining this to you that there is a subtlety in that it really pays off. I mean, really should consider the pairing between T and C double brackets Q in order to carefully prove that F5 really is a cuspidal modular form. Okay? All right, so that's almost everything. The upshot of this, though, is that if you can, in any way at all, by hook or crook, compute the Hecke algebra T, or some ring isomorphic to the Hecke algebra T, then all you have to do is figure out, you know, any time you write down a homomorphism from that ring to C, just a homomorphism of Z modules, C vector spaces, you get a modular format. Explicitly, here's what that means. So suppose you compute some module that is isomorphic to some sum of copies of S2 gamma 0 of n. For example, cuspidal modular symbols. then you choose a basis for that thing, and then you write down explicitly matrices of Hecke operators acting on it. Well, what's an example of a homomorphism from the group of all n by n matrices over C to C? Maybe I think of an example of a homomorphism from one to the other. No. That is not a C linear homomorphism. Oh, yeah. What's the easiest one you can think of? Well, zero. Yes. Wait, what did you say? An element, the matrix coefficients. So take the upper left entry. The trace, that's a good one. The trace is definitely a homomorphism from Heidegger. But a really, really simple one is just send matrix A to its Aij entry. In fact, that gives you a basis for the collection of homomorphisms from matrices to C. So here's all you have to do. If you want to compute a basis for S2 gamma 0 of n, one, compute the action of, compute matrices for Hecke operators on modular symbols. Take for each matrix the upper left-hand entry. And that will give you, that's a map which sends a Hecke operator to a complex number, namely the upper left-hand entry of the matrix of the Hecke operator. Now just write down this Q expansion to some precision. So you're taking the upper left-hand entry of the Hecke operator T1 times Q, plus the upper left-hand entry of the Hecke operator T2 times Q squared, plus the upper left-hand entry of the Hecke operator T3 times Q cubed, and so on. You'll have just written down a cuspidal modular form, an element of S2 gamma 0 of n. And then you do it again, do the same procedure, but instead of using the upper left entry of your matrix, you'll move one over. Use the 0, 1 entry of your matrix. And you'll write down a whole bunch of Q expansions to some precision. They together will give you a basis for S2 gamma 0 then. It's that simple. And I have lots of examples in the notes. Because I only have 9 minutes, instead of trying to set up my projector, which would take me 5 minutes, I'll just lead you through some of the examples in the notes, starting on page 58. So, notice first, though, that our approach to this whole problem is totally different than what we did with level 1. In level 1, we had two known modular forms we used as generator reading S. Here we don't have any, we just don't have some known modular forms. For example, if you take S2 gamma 0 of n, well, if you look at M2 gamma 0 of n, turns out it has dimension 2. There's one Eisenstein series and one cusp form. And you can't, like, go to any lower weight because you don't have anything in lower weights. So there's no way you're going to get that cusp form using Eisenstein series like we had in level 1. But you can get that cusp form via this procedure. And here's an example. I wrote down two matrices. Remember, I did this sort of thing on Monday. I wrote down matrices of Hecke operators acting on modular symbols. Modular symbols are isomorphic because of the integration pairing. They give you a module that is abstractly at least isomorphic to cusp forms up to tensor C, which is fine. So I wrote down two matrices here, the diagonal matrix of minus 2 and the diagonal matrix of minus 1, and the Hecke operator T1 is just the identity matrix. And then I just write down in the middle of page 58 the Q expansion where I'm just taking the upper left entry. So it's Q plus minus 2 times Q squared plus minus 1 times Q cubed, and so on. And that's an explicit element of S2 gamma 0 of 11. S2 gamma 0 of 11 has dimension 1, so that gives you a basis. Okay, let's do another example, level 33. So this time, the space of modular symbols that are cuspidal has dimension 6, and inside of there, you can compute Hecke operators acting on that space, and if you do so, what the code does that's given at the bottom of this page, the first thing where it says F00 equals that sum, it's just computing this sum right here, but where it's taking the upper left entry of each of the matrices of the Hecke operators. And it gets Q minus Q squared minus Q cubed plus Q to the fourth, and so on. And you're guaranteed by this argument I gave over here that that is the Q expansion of a cuspidal modular form of level 33. And I just repeat this a couple more times, and I get three different modular forms. Sometimes one matrix entry can give you something that's redundant that you've already seen up to linear independence. But eventually I get three independent ones, so I'm done, and they're listed in the middle of page 59. The next example is level 23, and at the very bottom of the page you can see two independent forms that you write down, again via this method. Okay. All right, so that is probably the simplest method for getting at modular forms using modular symbols. It's not really using much that's special about, it's using really nothing special about modular symbols, except that they're a module that if you tensor it with C, it's actually isomorphic to two copies of cusp forms. So it so it's a module that gives you a representation of the Heck algebra. But you're not using anything special about it. There's actually a lot more that you can do that uses the structure of modular symbols that's much more efficient than what I just described. But at least what I've described to you is complete, and it's pretty general. I mean, there are actually a lot of other ways to come up with representations of the Heck algebra. For example, using quaternion algebras, you can write down an ideal, basically a free abelian group on, sorry, an ideal. You can write down a module, which is the free abelian group on ideal classes in a certain order in a quaternion algebra. And in a lot of cases, that will also give you a representation of this ring. And again, by computing homomorphisms, you can write down Q expansions of modular, cuspidal modular forms. That works in a lot of generality, but there are some issues with it. Mainly, actually, computing the Heck operators, T sub 1, T sub 2, T sub 3, T sub 4, can be very, very time consuming. It's most efficient to compute them when they're prime, the prime indexed Heck operators, then you end up doing a lot of matrix multiplication to get the other Heck operators. And that's pretty hard work because the space of modular symbols is pretty big, and doing these matrix multiplications can really take a lot of time. Plus, the thing that you're really interested in, usually in practice, but again, this depends on the problem you're looking at, but very often you're really interested just in the elements of S2 gamma 0 then that are eigenvectors for all the Heck operators. And the method I just showed you, it finds a basis for this space, but in order to find the eigenvectors, you would then have to compute matrices for the Heck operators acting on this space using that definition or that formula. And that could be a lot of work because you need the Q expansions to high precision in order to apply this formula. So you could do it though, in theory. You could write down enough terms of all these Q expansions via writing down enough homomorphisms, via writing down enough Heck operators to write down the Heck operators directly on here, and then you could compute eigenvectors. But it's actually way, way easier to in the case of modular symbols, for example, to just directly find the eigenvectors in the spaces of modular symbols. And then each of the eigenvectors there gives you, if you just look at the map which sends a Heck operator to the eigenvalue of the Heck operator acting on your fixed eigenform, or sorry, your fixed eigenvector, so fix an eigenvector in modular symbols, and then consider that sends a Heck operator to the eigenvalue of the Heck operator acting on that eigenvector, then that gives you a ring homomorphism like this. And the ring homomorphisms, as I just mentioned before, are exactly in bijection with the Heck eigenforms over here. So really, that's often a better thing to do. You just figure out what the eigenvectors are, and then you move them back over here. And the really nice thing about eigenvectors is the prime indexed coefficients tell you all of the coefficients. Because you have a relation, if you have, well, the Heck operators satisfy this multiplicativity, and also T sub P to the R is equal to something in terms of smaller, well, it's a polynomial TP. That translates over to eigenvectors to say that if you know the coefficients A2, A3, A5, A7, and so on of your modular form, then you know all of them. You can just compute them using multiplication and the recurrence. So, instead of having to give all the Heck, in order to get a basis for the space up to, say, precision 1,000, instead of having to compute every Heck operator up to 1,000, and then using this formula, instead you just compute, you use this formula just for the eigenvectors, and then you compute the Heck operators T sub P for the primes up to 1,000. And there are way fewer primes up to 1,000 than there are integers up to 1,000. Then use the recurrence to write down all the other coefficients. And then from that, you can actually recover a whole basis. And only 168 primes up to 1,000, which is a lot smaller than 1,000. It's like a tenth the size, or seventh the size. Okay, so there's a lot more to this whole area. There's lots more tricks. I'm not going to go into too much detail. I'm going to start with Dirichlet characters on Wednesday. And I'll come back to this in more generality later.
I don't know. I just happen to know how many there are up to 1,000. How many primes are there up to 100?
20 something.
That's true. That's right.